Welcome to the True Falls Film Festival.
This is the True False podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofelt. We're going to do something a little different this episode and bring you tales from one of our favorite True False events, Campfire Stories. For those of you who haven't been, Campfire Stories is a time for filmmakers to sit around the fire, it's fake, listen to a soundtrack of chirping crickets, and eat s'mores. The s'mores are really, really good. Filmmakers talk about the shot they couldn't get, what they left on the cutting room floor, and ask each other questions. In this episode, we'll hear from four directors featured at True False 2017, whose films include Whose Streets, Dina, and The Force. The first storyteller, though, is Viktor Jakovlevsky. His film, Brimstone and Glory, explores one of Mexico's largest firework hubs.
Yeah, I made a film called Brimstone and Glory about a town of firework makers in Mexico that produces 80% of all the fireworks in all of Mexico. So every second person you meet is a firework maker, basically. And you see people with no finger, no hand, burns all over the body, no eye. You see it all. So one of the central characters in the film is a little boy who's kind of on the edge. He doesn't know yet what to become. He wants to be a firework maker, like every child. He's excited by the fireworks. And his family has been doing it for five generations, so the logical thing for him would be to become a firework maker. But that's not really what the film is about. The film is about him facing basically his biggest challenge, which is to go into the burning of the bulls. The burning of the bulls is part of an annual fireworks festival that this town does, which is completely insane. It's absolutely crazy. And the climax of this festival is the burning of the bulls, which means, I'm going to try to be short. The whole town starts making these gigantic bulls out of wire and paper mache, and they paint them and design them in these beautiful colors. Every bull is completely different. And to top it all off, they add 2,000 fireworks onto the bull, on a scaffold on the back of the bull. Now, you have to imagine those bulls, like the biggest one, this is the kind of the center of my story, is 9 meters long. I don't know what that is in feet. It's like 30 feet or something. It's a ginormous monster. It's just unbelievable. It goes on car wheels, you know, like on car wheels. Because when the day of the bull burning comes, before they burn them, they parade them through the town. Yeah. So the whole town is on the street, and there's like one route that they all go down. And it's these 400, 500, up to 600 bulls being pushed through the town, people cheering like a Tour de France, kind of, like ecstatic, you know. Having, of course, drinks, because, you know, we're in Mexico. On this day, they start drinking at 10 in the morning when the first bulls go on the circuit. And so we shot, the filming happened in three legs, in 2014, 15, and 16. And each time we filmed, went back, looked at the footage, went back again, looked, you know, at what we needed, and tried to get that. So the center of my story is the last year, 2016, where we went for a very specific reason. So at that time, we already understood that this little boy, Santi, is our main character. And the one thing that we kind of still needed for the film is to see him go into the bull burning fire. He is obviously way too young. He's like, in 2016, he was 12 years old. And this is something so scary that really children should not be in there, you know. But so we tried to, you know, I talked to him and I was like, look, I just want you to know, I don't want to push you to go in. I know you're too young. I just want you to know that for my film, it would kind of be cool if you did go into the fire, even if you just stand on the side. You don't have to go all the way in. And and he was like, yeah, maybe, you know, the days leading up to the main day, he was like going up and down, like, yes, no, yes, no. And when the final bull day came, he and his father were like, yeah, he's probably not going to go in. And I was like, yeah, no, that's fine. You know, maybe we can get some shots on the side so we can fake it with like some POV shots of being really inside and, you know. But anyway, So the parade started, you know, that's where my story now starts, actually. The parade started, everybody's pushing their bulls towards the main plaza where the burning is supposed to happen. And we lost him, you know, and so we run through this whole madness of people screaming to other bulls and like other bull crews and people drunk. We streamed through there trying to find him. We finally found like his bull. Like his bull also, as a side note, is the biggest bull in the whole festival. It's that 9-meter gigantic. It's called Toro Rey, the king of the bulls, yeah. And it's a monster, like 15 to 20 people have to actually push it so that it moves. It's so heavy. It's tons and tons of, yeah. So we find him and I'm super happy and he was just about like to take this like smoke machine in his hands. The bull stopped, you know, they stopped pushing. And he took the smoke like gun into his hands and starts running like in front of the bull, you know. And I was like, great. I grabbed the B camera and just like was emerged and like filming him. And I was like, oh, I was in my mind. I was like, oh, this is great. This is going to be like such a great shot. And like we can edit this so well, you know. I didn't see that they already started pushing the bull. And they didn't see me because they were probably way too drunk. And I was like kind of on the side, but still totally on the way of this, you know, of the circuit. And so 15 grown Mexican men drunk pushed the bull in full speed. This is not what I'm seeing. I see the boy. I see the display. I'm just like immersed into the shot. The next thing I know is that I'm on the floor and this gigantic beast coming right at me. Right at me, and I know how heavy it is, you know, and I just know like this could be it, I could be done in a second, but I hear them screaming, I was, stop, and they just in time stopped it, and the wheel, the left front wheel hit my stomach, but then thankfully like went back, so it didn't go over me. So what happened was, you know, obviously the bull hit me full on. And I was there on the floor, not even knowing what happened, but I look at my leg and I see all this blood streaming down, like my whole, like just down here, you know, like the whole pants are full with blood. And like people rush to me and start to get me up. And then I realized, okay, I was hit by this gigantic monster. And I was brought to the sideline, you know, and this is like, you know, the density of the crowd is like this. It's completely full, like you cannot move. You have to like push everybody away. So my producer, I was on my producer's shoulder. He set me down. Somebody came and like you know, cut the pants open, and like there was a gigantic wound, like so terrifying. I didn't dare to look at it. I just saw. I was like sitting down. All these people here around me, all these Mexicans, and I just see their face looking down, looking up, looking down, and just being like this. And I didn't dare to look down there, but. Anyway, they had to escort me to the next ambulance, and with the bicycle taxi. That's how this, like, in the town people get around, you know. And on this bicycle ride, I was just like laying there, like stretched with my legs. People taking photos of the wound, like these Mexicans. But all I could think of was that I'm probably not going to get the shot that I came to Mexico for again, because it was my job to get the reaction shots of the little boy in the fire, if he chose to go in. And so I called Ben Zeitel, my like, you know, my better half, my producer. I called him. Look, I cried. I was like, I totally messed it up. And he was like, calm down. We got this. I'm going to call like our Mexican cinematographer. I'm going to tell them what we need, and it's going to be fine. And I just like cried, and like they took me to the hospital. They stitched my wound with like 14 stitches, like 10 outside, 4 inside, you know. But then already I realized that the main issue was not the wound, but my knee. Like, eventually I found out that I had a torn ACL and a torn meniscus. So I couldn't really like step on my leg at all. It was completely messed up. But so I was in the hospital in total agony, like realizing that I just messed up everything. Like by not taking care in the decisive moment, you know, I was probably not going to get the shots that my film need. I saw my film failing in that moment, which was terrifying. But they gave me a lot of painkillers, you know, which was nice. It brought me back to the positive sphere. And I went back to the bull burning plaza. That was already at night, the bulls were already burning up, and we had like this, on the terrace, we had like a little area where we could like chill and look down. And I'm brought there, you know, like with a limp. And I finally meet my crew again. And they all come to me, storming, like, if I'm all right, of course, first. But then they're like, you won't believe what happened. And I'm like, what? So after you had the accident, Santi was completely shocked. He felt responsible, and he felt like it was also his fault because he's, you know, part of the bull. And so the crazy thing happened that him and his father decided to go into the bulls. And we have everything on camera. Like Axel, my camera operator, he stuck with him and he got those like amazing shots. And I couldn't believe it. I started crying. I was like, this is insane. And they told me how not only he didn't only stand on the line, but he went all the way in, which is of course terrifying. And you know, it's wrong in a way, but I saw that for the movie, this might be it, you know? And so, I looked at the footage and I couldn't believe it. Like he went in, he jumped like all the grown-ups. He like, you know, like tried to hide. His father was like protecting him from all the flying fireworks. It was unbelievable. And I realized that with a bit of reflection, I realized that this needed to happen because I don't think I would have gotten those shots. I think that me getting hit by the bull, like really letting go of what I was so eager to get, was exactly what needed to happen, you know. This is the story, yeah.
After the break, we'll hear the director of The Force tell a winding story about identity. Hey listeners, it's Allison. I want to recommend another podcast from you, also from KBIA. It's called Views of the News. Each week, host Amy Simons and her panelists take a look behind the headlines and analyze, criticize, and comment on trends in the media. That's Views of the News from KBIA. Check it out on whatever podcasting app you're using right now. This is the True-False podcast presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofelt. Let's get back to the campfire and hear from the Force director, Peter Nix.
So in 2012, I made a film called The Waiting Room, which some of you have seen. And the film got rejected by about 20 film festivals. And Paul and David basically discovered the film, played it here at True False, and in some ways it really altered the trajectory of my career as a filmmaker. The film went on to do incredibly well. It won a bunch of awards. It got nominated for a Spirit Award, won the Truth in Fiction Award, and so I found myself in Los Angeles at the Spirit Awards in 2012. And while you're at the Spirit Awards, and you know, I'm kind of a newbie, even though I'm a little bit older, I was a newbie in a sense. So, and I'm also an independent filmmaker, so I'm a bit of a hustler. And so you're in LA under the tent, and there's all these famous people there. So I see, you know, I spot out Harvey Weinstein, and I immediately figure I'm going to parlay this into something. And so I navigated past Jennifer Lawrence was there. I navigated past her because I was thinking strategically. I was like, I don't think Jennifer Lawrence can help me, but I think Harvey can help me. And somehow get there, and you know that thing where you're waiting for the right moment to sort of make the introduction, to sort of put your hand out there, and it's got to be timed just right. And I thought I had it perfect. Reached my hand out, was about to speak. Harvey was looking right at me. And the hand went right by me to the guy that was standing behind me. Just destroyed me, right? I was like, what a jackass. And I'd heard stories about this guy. But I let it go. Because I was still basking in the glow of the film getting the attention that it got. So, flash forward 2 years. The Waiting Room really was the film that sparked my idea to start telling the story of Oakland, California through the public institutions that either serve or don't serve this community. And that film led to the idea, we were sort of, Linda and Lawrence, if they were here, we were sitting in a room talking about, you know, what are we going to do next? And it dawned on us that, you know, going inside an American police department at this moment in time would be a worthwhile journey to take. This was before Ferguson, it was before Black Lives Matter was a hashtag. Our conception of the film was somewhat different in the beginning. There had been, you know, Oscar Grant had been shot in Oakland, there was Trayvon Martin, and there was some resonance in the country about this conversation, but it hadn't quite reached the pitch that it eventually would. When we began making the film, we had a completely different idea of what we were going to do. It was going to primarily be a film about reform, what reform looked like at an American police department. This was a department that had been forced to reform because of past civil rights violations. The Ryder's case, if anyone's familiar, led to a federal oversight of the department, and they let us in, allowed us to document what was basically the final stage of that. Of that process. And for me, as a member of this community, as a Black filmmaker, having grown up in the Black church, gone to Howard University, I found myself in a very sort of difficult situation. And early on in our research, we were, you know, doing ride-alongs with the cops. Activists were taking our picture, putting it up on Twitter, and creating narratives around. Sort of me and my intent, and it was just trying to keep sort of focused and ignore that was very difficult. Trying to reconcile my identity as a Black filmmaker, trying to understand my responsibility, whose story was I going to tell? In the interim, since Ferguson had happened, Black Lives Matter emerged. The stakes had gotten much higher. And I was really sort of deeply questioning sort of my role in this process. Coincidentally, my wife, we had been having conversations. I did grow up in a Black family. I went to Howard University, but I was adopted. I was adopted in 1968. And I've always known some loose details about the circumstances under which I was adopted, but this was 1968. I knew my birth mother was white, my birth father was Black. Her family, this was in Ohio, in Akron, Ohio. Her family threatened to disown her if she kept me and married my birth father. So it was an agonizing decision, and I knew a little bit of this narrative because in 2000, I made my thesis film in film school was about the impact that my drug addiction had on my friends and family. I dropped out of Howard, gotten addicted to cocaine, gotten arrested, sentenced to a year in federal prison. And so I made a film about that. And in the process of making that film, I wanted to find out where I came from. And so I sent a letter to the adoption agency where I was adopted, trying to get information about my birth mother. And they basically, said, they gave me a short, basic narrative with very little information. And that was it. And this is roughly 2000. So, flash forward, I struggled mightily for many years working in the business as a TV producer, eventually went on to make The Waiting Room, was in production on The Force, was confronting these very dramatic questions about race and identity and power and justice. And my wife, who's always kind of nudged me to try to find my birth parents, said, why don't you try again? She was young when she had you. She was 18 at the time. And so I said, all right. So I wrote out the paperwork, sent it into the court in Cuyahoga County. Forgot about it. We're in production on this film. I had more than my hands full. I've got two young kids, so I basically forgot about it. One day, came home from a long shoot. I remember we were out. It was a protest there had been an officer-involved shooting in Oakland, and there was a protest, and we were out all night, and I was exhausted, and I came home, and I found a letter in the box that was from the court in Ohio, and I kind of knew at that moment, I kind of was, ooh. And so I opened it, and inside that envelope was my original birth certificate. Now, the birth certificate that I've always used said Peter Nix on it, with my parents' names on there. And this one was different, and it said Baby Boy Harris. And in that envelope was a photocopy of a document that was signed 2 weeks after the date that I sent in the request for information back in 2000, signed by Susan Harris from Appleton, Maine, with an address. With the dress and everything, right? And it was, you know, it's hard to really encapsulate the power of that moment. Everything, all of my focus sort of went to that. Now, this had happened, you know, talk about email, pre-email or letter writing, and you know, I think I got your beat on the dated part, but
okay.
If I'll give you that. We have the internet now, so I got on the internet, you know, typed in bang 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 bang. We find her, you know, Susan Harris. She's still living in Maine. She's married to a guy named David Glasser. They have a daughter named Mikey Glasser. Go up on Facebook, type in Mikey Glasser. She's friends with like a whole gang of my friends. Including Ben Fowley, who's not here, who would like really enjoy the story. Were he here, I'm gonna have to tell it to him next time I see him. Ben Fowley, who runs the Camden Film Festival. So my head's spinning. We're trying to figure out what are we gonna do, how are we gonna approach her. I'm making this film, probably the most intense, most difficult film of my life. And so I just decided to write a letter. And this is coincidentally about 3 weeks before my birthday, which is May 2nd. And this is a woman who every May 2nd since 1968 has thought of me. And but for me, I had parents growing up. I was adopted by a wonderful family. I never had that sort of loss. So I was very nervous about sending this letter, but I had to do it. Sent the letter, and about a week and a half later, got a letter in return, and arranged to speak to her on my birthday, May 2nd. The day came around. Coincidentally, David Glasser, her husband, had a heart issue, and so she was calling me from the waiting room at the hospital in Cleveland, and that was the first time we spoke. And I got to learn about her. It was a very awkward conversation, very profound conversation, but I got to learn a lot in a very short period of time. And along with learning that Mikey went to high school with Ben Fowley and is very connected to the, she's an artist and she lives in New Orleans and she teaches and she's a potter, which is partly why she has so many friends that are sort of connected with my circle of sort of arty friends. So David Glasser, I was born in 1968, about 14 years later, my birth mother met David Glasser. And they had a daughter, Mikey. Now, David, his Aunt Miriam, this is what I discovered. His Aunt Miriam and Uncle Max, Miramax, are Harvey Weinstein's parents.
What are you talking about?
Okay? David Glasser, who married my birth mother, is Harvey's first cousin. So I actually have many, many stories about Harvey in the Weinsteins, which I can't tell you today, but maybe some other time. So that's my story.
Next, we'll hear one of the directors of Dina talk about an unlikely friendship. Remember, you can subscribe and download every episode using iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. And we really encourage you to leave us a review on iTunes or give us a shout out on social media. That helps more people find our show. Thanks. You are listening to the True False podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofeldt. In this episode, we find ourselves in the Corner Playhouse on the Friday of the Fest, a space we make believe is a clearing in the woods. There, we host Campfire Stories, our annual filmmaker chat. We gathered around and heard Dan Sickles, co-director of Dina, tell a story.
It's a story that takes place a decade before we started working on Dina. And it's about this guy named Carl. And Carl, I grew up with him. My dad was a special ed teacher at the local high school where I grew up in Pennsylvania. And Carl, I probably met him when he was like in his late 20s. And he had Down syndrome. And his parents died when I was little. And my dad became his legal guardian. And, you know, to backtrack a bit too, I guess, the way that I think of like working on docs sometimes, it's like kind of similar to I guess being on LSD. Like there, it's like it's kind of mind expanding, you know. It's an opportunity to like really try and learn about something that you don't understand yet, at least for me. And you know, I had all these kind of preconceived notions about who Carl was or what he was capable of, and you know, I think because my dad was also giving him so much attention, I was a bit jealous too. And you know, I have memories of being like 13 years old and like taking Carl to Disney World and stuff like that, and just being miserable that I had to share a room with this dude, and you know, just being a brat. I mean, I was like a hormonal, selfish teenager, you know, and he was nothing but incredible and generous and sweet and playful and just real, real bright. And I was 18. I had just turned 18, and Carl called me like out of the blue, and he was like, "Dan, like, can we hang out? Can we get lunch?" And Carl like never really asked me personally for anything. So I knew that it was kind of important to him, and I was like, "Cool." And I picked him up in like my Toyota Sienna minivan, and he told me to drive him to the mall. So we went to the mall, and he like kind of told me to park towards like the back of the parking lot. It's like one of those big suburban parking lots. It's actually in our film. And he took me to like, you know, those like little bays where like one tree is kind of just chilling. It's like those like little tree islands, you know, like amidst all this concrete. And we walked over there, and like he kind of sat me down underneath this tree in the parking lot. And he looked at me, and it was very, I don't know, I like have the image of how he looked when he asked me, but he was like, "Danny," because he called me Danny, and he was like, "If something happens to your dad, can you be my legal guardian?" And I was like getting a D in calculus, like, you know, my car was busted and I still couldn't afford, like, and I was like, what do I know about like being someone's like legal guardian? Like, I don't know how to do any of that, you know? I don't know how to take care of myself, you know what I mean? And he was kind of just like waiting for a response for a second, because I really didn't know what to say. And there wasn't really an option. So, you know, I turned and I'm like, you know, Carl, like absolutely. Like, you know, I'm there, like, 100% for you, like, whatever you need. And in that moment, you know, again, like, up until that point, I was like, he has Downs. Like, it's like, not what does he know is a bit dramatic, but it's just kind of,
You know, I feel like I grew up with this mentality that was always reducing communities like this to just people who need things and can't necessarily provide anything for anyone else. And again, that was like my 18-year-old stupid, ignorant, selfish, hormonal self. And it was in that moment that I learned the value of really being upfront with people about your needs and asking for them, and how simple but also courageous that is, you know. And he had no problem with it. Like he brought me to the tree, and like we sat under the tree, and that was really nice. But he was just so straight up, you know. And that's something that I learned. It exists everywhere in you know, neurodiverse communities. Like, generally speaking, you know, it's the same for Dina and Scott and the people who populate our film. That they're really, really good about being upfront with what they need or what their limitations are or what their fears are. And it's so courageous and so valuable to be that way. And it came out of nowhere, this little nugget of wisdom, like how to live better. And it came from this unexpected source, you know. And I think that there is like some sort of line from like that moment to, you know, our first film, which was about a community that I really knew nothing about. It's a film called Mala Mala that focuses on trans culture in Puerto Rico. And then to Dina, you know, which is focusing on Dina, who I also grew up with and who knew me before I was born. But yeah, like I see like the thread from like that conversation with Carl to like seeking out experiences that widen my perceptions and expand my mind in ways that like I could never anticipate, you know. So there's no real end to the story. I mean, Carl ended up passing away when we were filming Mala Mala, actually. He was about 35 when he passed. And I don't know, I think about him all the time, and especially in situations like these, you know, where we're talking about what we do and then we're showing our film and stuff like that, you know. It's like he gave that to me, you know, who was working tirelessly to then try and give that to other people, I guess. So yeah, that's it. Thank you.
We're listening to Campfire Stories from our 2017 fest. Here's director Sabah Folayan of the film Whose Streets.
At this time, 3 years ago, I was about a year out of college, working at a nonprofit organization that dealt with reentry, so helping people who were incarcerated to try to put their lives back together. And to help people who were in prisons and jails stay connected with their families, because, you know, when you become a part of the criminal justice system, it's not like your life just stops, it's not like your family stops missing you and your bills stop piling up or anything like that. So I was privileged to be doing that work. And in that work, I got the opportunity to interview all of the employees at this, you know, nearly 50-year-old organization, and I got to interview people from each of their programs and really see how this thing worked. I was doing strategic planning, and my purpose was to get them to meet their 7 strategic goals that they had, and it was a year-long program, AmeriCorps. So with AmeriCorps, the deal is you live at the poverty level of whatever city you're working in. So I'm in New York City, I'm living in Manhattan, and I'm making $1,000 a month. So August 31st, 2014 was when that program was over. August 9th, 2014 was when Michael Brown Jr. was killed. And as I had worked there and as I had interviewed all of these people and learned their stories, And I interviewed everybody from the direct service people who were working with incarcerated folks to the executive staff who were overseeing this. And, you know, what I kept finding was every time I would sit down with people, they were thanking me after these interviews. And I'm asking them these tough questions. I'm asking them about how this work is affecting them. And I'm asking them about trauma. And I'm asking them about how they feel and their depression and their anxieties. And I'm getting all these stories that, you know, a lot of the conversations we were having had very little to do with the final goals and the organization and the work, but I recognized really early in the process that there was some value to just this interaction. And I've always been this person that people like to come up to and tell their life story. And I'm kind of an introvert by nature, so I'll just find myself at a party, like, cornered, and somebody's giving me their whole thing, and I don't really know what to do with it, and I don't know how to get out of it smoothly, so I'm just there. So this was the first time that this thing had been useful to me, because I found that I was asking people questions, I was getting all of this information, and I realized in some way I was doing something for them. That felt really good. Before I'd been working here, I was pre-med in college. I had taken the MCAT, and the scores are good for 3 years, and I was getting kind of frustrated. I remember taking this bioethics course. I'm at Columbia University. It's supposed to be like the best of the best, and I'm taking this bioethics class, and I remember this one hypothetical situation, and it was about what if a pregnant woman came in and needed a procedure and didn't have insurance. And we had this whole long debate about it, and I remember just sitting in class and feeling sick because I thought that everyone here wanted to be a doctor, and I didn't understand why we were debating whether or not we would treat someone if they needed it. And so that was like when I really got an inkling that maybe I wasn't going down the right path. Maybe this wasn't a place that was gonna allow me to express this need to heal that I felt. And so I took the MCAT, 3 years on the scores, and I was like, I'm gonna take 2 of these years to figure something out. And if I haven't figured it out in 2 years, I'm going to med school because, you know, we have to have a career. I come from a family where, you know, you pursue your education to the fullest, you work, we have to be successful, we have to do better, we have to be better than the people who came before us, we have to prepare for the people who are coming next. And so art never really occurred to me as something viable. So a year in, and I'm at this nonprofit, and I've done all these interviews, and I've generated this report, and I take it to the executive, and they're like, wow, great. Okay, next. And it was just like this kind of amazing thing, and then this deflation, because I really quickly realized that, you know, this was kind of a thing that felt good to do, but it wasn't going anywhere. They were not committed to the kind of examination and change that would need to happen to actually honor all of these stories and these experiences. And it would take me working there for 10, 15 years, working my way up to a point where I could maybe have some influence here. And that just wasn't speaking to me. And so that whole summer was a really difficult summer in the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I was seeing images that were coming out of Gaza, and it was just breaking my heart, these children and what was going on. I didn't have a lot of context at the time about the history of that relationship, but I just knew that something was wrong. And so, like any millennial, I started ranting on social media. And so I'm just furiously, I'm status after status, tweet after tweet. And people started coming up to me, and people who I knew, thanking me for what I was doing and messaging me and kept thanking me. And I didn't understand why anyone would be thanking me because I wasn't doing anything. My brother called me one time and he was like, listen, Mike, you need to be careful about what you're saying on the internet. Like, this could really affect your future. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, this is just my Facebook. Like, I didn't really get the magnitude of what was going on or what I was participating in. And so when Michael Brown was killed and when Ferguson happened, there was just this pull for me. So I went, and my goal was to show that there was grounds for at least some research into the public health situation there. And it was to say that there was gonna be a trauma inflicted on this community, the police, the citizens, everyone involved. There were gonna be long-term physiological effects of being in that fight or flight mode, day after day, night after night, over and over, that does something to your body. And I think anybody who has lived through a stressful ordeal or lived through a stressful ordeal that's lasted for weeks or months or years, you know how there's that feeling, and there are things that trigger you and take you back to that place. It's a real biological thing that happens. It's totally natural and normal. But when there isn't a community and an infrastructure to respond to that trauma and to support people through healing, it can become something negative. It can become something that has, you know, really adverse impact. So I wanted to go in and say, maybe we can look at this from a medical perspective. Maybe we can diffuse this by looking at how it's affecting everyone. So I typed up this little survey pamphlet. Lucas, my director of photography, his parents, or his mom's husband, worked in this field. So he sat with me and you know, worked through these questions I was gonna ask, and I'm ready. So I printed out like 100 of these copies. And I don't even know if we actually took them out of the trunk, because when we got there, you know, the situation was not one where you could come to someone with a piece of paper and check off, how have you been sleeping lately? Are you feeling irritable? So, you know, inevitably we started asking questions, and he went from taking photos to rolling. And we got our first interview, which ended up being the first scene in the film. And I remember us going home that night, and just, we had this feeling of, you know, it was like, we didn't know what this was gonna be. We didn't know about the documentary film industry and all of the things that were possible, and these amazing festivals and the artists and the energy. We didn't know necessarily that all that was out there, but we knew we had to see this through. And it just felt like, everything just kept feeling so right, like somehow it just kept feeling right. And I remember we left, we went home, and we knew we needed to come back, and we didn't know how we were gonna get there. So we're in New York. I didn't have a job this time. I had given up my apartment at the end of my AmeriCorps gig, went to crash on someone's couch, because the person I had been living with, I've been subleasing from, I don't know if anyone's from New York, but the housing situation is crazy. So I found out, he had not been giving my $600 out of my monthly $1,000 to our landlord. I don't know what he was doing with it, but we got an eviction notice, and we were like months behind in rent. And I'm like, dude, if we're not paying rent, just let me know, because I got other stuff to do with that money. Like, you don't have to hide it, but like, don't take it. So, so I packed my stuff up, called my friend up. I'm like, listen, I'm gonna sleep on your couch. And, you know, that was about another year of couch surfing and going back and forth to St. Louis. And I remember there was this night, and we were like, how are we going to get back? We need to get back. Ferguson October was coming up, this big national event that they threw. And I get a call from Lucas, and he's like, my neighbor's going to let us use their car. I remember I was in Prospect Park laying on the grass, looking up at the sky, and there's this big circle of clouds, and it was just like this really eerie thing. And I get this phone call, and it's like, we got a car. And so, you know, the next day we hop in the car, we make the drive back to St. Louis, and that was the first of 17,000 miles that we eventually put on that old 99 Honda Accord, bless her. and so, you know, we're back there, and we're still filming, and we're like, we have to do this with someone for the community, and we keep hearing this name, Damon Davis. A little bit of time goes by, and we finally go to this exhibit that is curated by Damon Davis and facilitated also by Chris Renteria, who became our co-producer. And I'm looking at this amazing art, and it's just futuristic and political and beautiful, and just, you know, whoever did this is great. And, you know, we connected at that point, and it was just immediately all of our values aligned, our goals aligned. I remember our first conversation, Damon was like, listen, I'm from this city. Like, I, these people are my friends and family. I want to make a film, but if I'm making a film, I need to be the director. And we had about a 45-minute conversation. I'm like, look, like, I appreciate that. I respect that. You're entitled to this story, but, you know, I've been working on this for a little while, and I kind of feel like, you know, maybe we could share. And he's like, yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, I knew from that conversation that this was a person that I was gonna be able to work with and navigate through. And it sounds like a lighthearted conversation, but, you know, asking somebody to share authorship over a story about people who they intimately know, and I'm a stranger to this community, really. It was a real exchange of trust in that moment, and it just happened so fluidly and naturally that it just again felt really, really right. And so, you know, there's so many more stories I could tell, and there's so many people, even in this room, who are a part of it. These moments where it just seemed like every single thing was lining up in ways that we couldn't explain. And this was an extremely hard process, extremely rigorous, took a great deal of organization, great deal of dedication, strategy, and planning. But there's just this little X factor that I can't explain that really, I think, takes this project and takes art to that next level. And I think it's, you know, what you're talking about when it's just right and you're really, really connected and your heart is really, really, really in it. You know, the experience itself becomes so rewarding. And so, you know, my story is about just, you know, what do a medical student and a filmmaker have in common? It's what a good film and the process of converting, you know, carbon and oxygen into energy have in common. It's this way that things are interconnected and must work together in synchronicity. And the way that the experiences of your life, all of them seem to just prepare you for wherever you are. And so I'm just so, so, so grateful for having this opportunity. I'm grateful that this exists. I'm grateful that True False exists. I'm grateful that people, like the people who are in this room, exist, because, you know, I spent a lot of time being really cynical and feeling like the only way to have a happy life was to make money and then eventually be comfortable enough to write a book and then hope someone like steals it and makes a movie out of it and then you can sue them for money. Yeah, again, like, no, I don't have a great like punctuation mark, but I just am really, really honored to be here, and I just feel like, you know, documentary film is just such a magical thing because there are so many X factors, there's so much outside of your control, and when all of the pieces can come together for a film to be actually completed, and then when an audience comes and sees the film and adds that extra layer of energy and interpretation and feeling and recognition to it, it's just magic.
We want to thank these directors for sharing their stories with us, and we want to thank the Campfire Stories audience at True False. To check out more episodes of our podcast, subscribe and download it on iTunes, or find us at kbia.org. This episode was produced by Callie Luna and edited by Bram Sablesmith and Ryan Femuliner. Our music was created by Tim Pilcher using sounds of the True False Film Fest. Special thanks to Haley Godburn, Danielle Hogarty, and Todd Chin. I'm Allison Kofeld. Thanks for listening.